Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together. In other words, we're here to address actual issues rather than defend positions. Well, as the Swami has said, the evolution has begun. We have fired the first big shot. Now, while Trump may be gone, Trumpism remains. A lot's been written about Donald Trump's psychological issues personally, and yet his appeal, particularly to a certain type of man, remains a bit of a mystery. Many, many people, and certainly a majority of adult Americans, recognize Donald Trump as a self-serving liar and con artist. However, others hold him as a hero, an upholder of American values, and the final firewall between our freedom and a top-down totalitarian one-world government. Well, our guest this week is Jed Diamond. He's been studying men's health and psychology for more than half a century. Nearly 5 years ago, in May of 2016, he predicted that Donald Trump would become the next president. In that prophetic article, he pointed to Donald Trump's childhood of serious abuse, neglect, and abandonment. Then he warned that other men who have suffered similar indignities would relate to Trump and revile the same establishment forces that he does. Earlier this month, we witnessed groups such as the Proud Boys, who showed up armed in Washington, D.C. to storm the Capitol in support of their fearless leader. But maybe it wasn't fearlessness, but fearfulness running them. So how do we address this psychological disease that nearly caused democracy's demise? How do we reach real people struggling with their personal pain and projecting it out onto the world? And how do we uncover the real concerns that these wounded men and others hold and bring them up and out for resolution? Our guest, Jed Diamond, a PhD, is the founder and director of Men Alive, a health program that helps men live long and well. Jed is the author of 17 books, including his most recent, My Distant Dad, Healing the Family Father Wound. His previous books include The Enlightened Marriage, The Five Transformative Stages of Relationships, and Why the Best is Still to Come. He's also written The Irritable Male Syndrome, and he's written 12 Good Rules for Men. He is also a member of the International Society of Men's Health and a founding member of American Society for Men's Health. He is the only male columnist who blogs for the National Association of Baby Boomer Women. Okay, eager to get into this conversation. Welcome, Jed.
Good to be with you. There's a lot going on in the world, clearly.
Definitely. So let's just jump back to that article that you wrote in 2016. What was it actually that convinced you that Trump was not just electable, but would likely be elected?
Well, as a psychotherapist, I'm always looking at what are the changes and concerns that are going on inside people's minds and their hearts and their feelings. And then as a psychologist and sociologist and evolutionist, I'm interested in how what's going on inside relates to what's going on outside in the world. And what I was seeing outside is that there were significant changes going on in society, and specifically two changes that I think were of concern and created fear in a lot of people. One was the whole change in the balance within the country between white people, Anglo people, and people of color, as there are more Hispanics, more blacks, more feeling that the balance between white and non-white was starting to tip. And a lot of people were afraid of that. We're afraid that we're going to lose our country to them, the other. And that was one fear that I was seeing. The second was a change in the power between men and women. And women were beginning to express more of their desire to take charge of their own lives, to have positions of power in society. And again, I felt that there were significant parts of the larger community, particularly white men, that were fearful of that. And so when I heard Donald Trump speak, I felt these merging of outward fears and inward woundedness between what I knew about Trump's early life, and we know now a lot more from his niece, you know, who wrote the book about the family life and the things she saw. But even then, I was recognizing some of the woundedness and father wound in particular of growing up with a father that was very, you know, demanding and very abusive in some ways, and how that affected Donald Trump's brother and other family members. So all of that together, I made a prediction, as you pointed out, in May 2016, before I think anybody was taking, or at least many people were taking, Donald Trump seriously as a candidate, that not only did I feel he could win, but that he would, because he was tapping into some of the deep concerns in the larger society. And I also warned of the consequence of a man like that with those wounds and those fears, if they became president, how that would affect the larger community in the United States and the rest of the world.
Well, you know, you used three terms that in that article that related to Trump and perhaps other men: abuse, neglect, abandonment. Now, how widespread are these, and how do they all relate to glomming onto somebody like Donald Trump?
Well, I think there's a couple of, you know, bridges that make sense to me. One is the fairly extensive experience that many people have, men and women. So obviously, you know, Donald Trump triggers something in men, and there's an identification with some men and a tapping into some of the fears that some men have. But women also obviously voted for Trump, feel, you know, strongly connected. And I think there's a connection between that and many people, a large percentage, probably 50, 60, 70%, when you actually test this with large numbers of people, grew up in families where there was some degree of abuse, neglect, abandonment, everything from divorces, where you grew up without a stable family, where there's neglect, there's addiction, there's mental illness in the family. This is fairly common now within the society. And specifically, as you pointed out, one of the books I wrote, My Distant Dad, Healing the Family Father Wound, where there is an abusive or an absent or a dysfunctional father. And in this case, when you have that, you have a wound and also a hunger to try to find a father figure that will, again, all of this is unconscious. Very few people are aware, saying, oh yeah, well, I never had a good father, or I had a father that was abusive and neglectful or bad, so I'm going to find somebody like that I'm going to glom onto. Some do it in their relationship. They marry guys like that. Some become guys like that. And some, if there's a candidate who has some power, then reach out and vote for and then pay allegiance to a father like that. And you would think logically, if you had a bad experience, you would go, I don't want to get in another relationship like that. But subconsciously, what we do, why we marry people that we're like our family, is that it's familiar. You know, it feels like home. And so some of those patterns of abuse, neglect, and abandonment show up in a desire to vote for and then pay allegiance to somebody who may be abusive, neglectful, or in some way wounded.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking it may have been as early as the 1940s that a writer named Philip Wiley identified something that he called momism. Are you familiar with that term at all?
Yes, I've heard of it. Uh-huh, and I know that idea.
So somehow back, 70 or 80 years ago, there was something happening to the male authority, something happening in relation to men. What was that? What was that that shifted our sense of respect and self-respect that men have and the influence on the son?
Yeah, there are a number of things that were happening, you know, in that period in the 40s and the 50s. You know, on the surface, it was the time people look back on of everything was fine. You know, it was Leave It to Beaver. It was the all-American family. It was, what's good for General Motors is good for the world kind of attitude. It was like a very homogeneous, very comfortable, but under the surface, and for people that weren't, you know, white middle class or upper class, it was not so pretty and was not so serene. But increasingly, from then on, a couple of things were going on. One was, as I said, the non-white world was no longer, this is still obviously going on, you know, from before the Civil War, from people bringing slaves over, and the after the Civil War, the move out of the South into the North, and these shifts of race were going on, and then the shifts of the male-female balance, where men traditionally back then were the leaders of the family and they were the breadwinners, and the women's job was to stay home, take care of the children, do what they were told. The father ran the house. God the Father was up in the sky, who told the man of the house what to do, who told the women and children what to do. Well, clearly that world was changing. And it was frightening to some of the people that tried to hold on to that old world. And obviously for those that were becoming more outspoken, more liberated, whether they're people of color or women, this was a shift that clearly was inevitable, was going to happen. You can't keep people in restrictive roles forever. And that was happening. And then the idea of momism was that feeling and that experience that the father was somehow being replaced, that strong figure, and now moms were ruling things. And the father was, two forces. They were losing their power, but increasingly marriages were starting to fall apart more. There was fathers that were leaving the home, fathers that were divorced or left, abandoned. So again, there was a wound. There was somebody quoted, I can't remember the author, but they said, increasingly people were experiencing a hole in their soul in the shape of their father. And so that was that feeling of a wound, a hole in the soul because of the missing father. Either he was missing in physical or emotional, or he himself was feeling less relevant. He didn't know what his role was anymore. And that was part of his own feeling of abandonment, feeling like the family is abandoning him, which we still see today. And a lot of anger that you see in men that they don't feel connected anymore. They don't feel relevant. They don't feel they know who they are. And that's part of where the authoritarian leader comes in and says, follow me. I know where you need to go. Follow me and I'll take you to the promised land. I'll take you to the good old days before you lost your power.
Well, you know, we're talking about also World War II, where two things happened. First of all, you know, since black people fought in World War II, there was a sense after the war was over that they really had to be integrated into society. You know, so 1947, you know, saw the breaking the color barrier in baseball. Then, of course, we had Rosie the Riveter, who was able to essentially be out there as part of the workforce. And then all of a sudden, the husband comes home from the war. Back in those days, they didn't call it PTSD. You just kind of sucked it up.
Right.
And so we had all of these stored up dysfunctions. I want to say something about, I'm going to have a break in a few minutes, so we're going to get interrupted, but just to lay the question out before the break, the article that you wrote 4 years ago, you used the term strongman and suggested that strong men, I put that in quotes, are not strong. And then we now have this group called the Proud Boys. They're not called the Proud Men, they're called the Proud Boys. So we come back from break, let's address this boys to men passages and pride. Okay, and we'll take a short break. We're going to be back with Jed Diamond. We're going to be talking about the impact of men, psychology behind Trumpism, and what we can do about it. Steve Behrman, back in a few minutes.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at eji.org.
Okay, we're back with Jed Diamond, and we're talking about men's health, men's well-being, men's psychology, and we're also talking about groups like the Proud Boys and the whole idea of strong men. What can you tell us about the Proud Boys, and why are they boys?
Well, I don't know details about that movement, but what I can tell you, let me kind of tie into the strong men idea first, because it then ties into some of the ways this is used. There's two ways in which I talk about strong men. One is strong and one word, and men is a second word. It's, you know, the colloquial way in which we think, you know, a positive, you need to be a strong man. When it's used as a single word, and where its most recent expression of this strongman is in a book, a recent book that was written by historian Ruth Ben Gyatt. Subtitle is Mussolini to the Present. And there she looks at 20th century strongmen, everyone from Hitler to Mussolini to President Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And she talks about what they have in common and the whole historical rise to power for people like Mussolini and Trump and Putin and Hitler, to many other strongmen leaders that have emerged as dictators, basically, as those that either are elected first and then take over, you know, the government. And she describes in much detail who these people are, what they're like, and where you then see followers of the, you know, there's a lot of groups presently that stormed the Capitol that are part of this kind of reaction against some of the change, that are wanting to, you know, stop, let's go back to the past, Nazis, neo-Nazis, fear of women. In the book, she has a whole chapter on the cult of virility, because a lot of these strongmen, these dictator-type men, are wounded internally, externally. They seek power. They're narcissistic. They're also often very abusive of women. They hunger for adulation. And she talks about a number of the different people, including Donald Trump. The followers then put out names that sound, you know, very manly on one level, but they reveal themselves in some of the names that they describe, like the Proud Boys. And it turned out, I looked them up, and the name Proud Boys, which again was supposed to be a, you know, powerful macho, you know, it turned out it came from a Disney movie of, you know, a proud to be a boy. And it revealed itself as the child connection, that really what many of these macho, out there, aggressive, angry men are really, again, looking for a father figure. They're looking for somebody to nurture them, to care for them, to, you know, like a strong father man figure would. And hopefully, you know, many people have good, strong, positive, nurturing, caring fathers. But that's what you hear, I think, in the picking of the name, Proud Boys, rather than these are not strong, really strong men, but they're really wounded boys looking for a father figure to guide them. And that's why they glom on to, you know, historically, people like Hitler, people like Mussolini, people like Vladimir Putin, you know, who give the appearance of manly strength. And again, give the idea, if you follow me, we'll give you purpose. And usually the purpose has to do with the demeaning of some group, some them, that we're going to protect you from, whether it's the Jews or whether it's the black people or the brown people or the people that are coming that are going to take over our families. We have to build a wall to keep them out. These are the kind of traits of the strongman dictator that look for followers who can, you know, give them a sense of their own value and power, because they don't feel internally powerful. They feel wounded and hungry for narcissistic attention.
You know, at the same time, we have to consider that there are external forces that have impacted the well-being of these men, often economic, often, you know, coming up against limitations on jobs. You know, we have twice as many people in this country as we had 50 years ago, twice as many people on the world. So all of these pressures are adding up. And of course, if we look back to the post-World War I Germany, the country was suffering under this horrific inflation, and it was very easy for people to feel oppressed and looking at some kind of a nationalism, a nationalist movement, in order to restore that collective sense of belonging and so on. So how does this individual, I'm going to unwrap this a little bit, how does the individual feeling disenfranchised, feeling alienated, feeling neglected, discarded, abandoned, relate to a larger class of people in this country that are sharing that kind of feeling collectively?
Yes. Well, that's why these personal wounds turn into social movements. It's because a couple of factors, and you've hit on the two general ones, is there are real problems in the society that are not being met. So unemployment, war, a not just disenfranchisement or a disconnection, but a feeling of devaluing. And that particularly hits men, a feeling that you are being shamed or disconnected, or that feeling of discharged or dismissed. And basically the slang on the streets is, he dissed me. And so there's that feeling of, you're not worthy, you're nothing, that touches particularly men's feeling of self-worth. And so between real problems, like unemployment, there are real problems of climate change that affect everybody. And we do, we're not solving those problems very well. We have problems of, conflict between political parties that aren't getting solved, problems between men and women. So when these problems accumulate and they're not being solved, we look for two things that authoritarian leaders give is, one, somebody that will make you feel proud of yourself again, somebody that says, I understand you, I care about you, and if you follow me, I will solve the problems. We will get our country back again. So the desires are real, and the need for change is real, and the need to solve problems is real. The problem is, and Ruth Benjat in her book points this out, that authoritarian leaders, and I think we saw it very clearly with Donald Trump, don't really solve the problems. They just pretend to. And in fact, the problems get worse. And that's why, the authoritarian leaders, eventually they get toppled, they get into wars, in their woundedness, they do things that make problems worse rather than better. But if we don't solve real problems, eventually people will rebel, and often the rebellion isn't, let's rebel and fix things. That would be good. There are people, Black Lives Matter is a good example, are saying we need to fix things. We need to, to come together in a healthy way. We need to recognize our differences and fix things, as opposed to let's look for a scapegoat and let's look for somebody to blame and let's go after them while the real problems are neglected. So it's not an easy fix, because you have to deal with the most wounded, acting out, angry, that just want to destroy everything. They're so wounded, they just want to blow everything up kind of people. And then the less disconnected, who say, something's wrong here, let's fix it. And hopefully there will and are more people that go, I'm with you, you're right, things are broken here, let's solve the real problems and let's come together to do it, so that we're not segmenting and fragmenting ourselves, blaming each other.
In using the word pride and proud and so on, there's another aspect that is shame. And just out of curiosity, what do you sense is the role of shame? How does shame play itself out? And How does one come out from under that that bushel that we hide ourselves in, or isolate ourselves?
Yeah. Well, it's a very key issue. That's what I said. This whole notion, when we look at male violence, you know, both individual violence, people that, you know, kill each other, or people that end up in jail or in prison. The underlying reason, you know, they may have gotten there because they murdered somebody or they shot somebody, but when you talk to them, and I've talked to many, is what it gets down to is the feeling that they disrespected me, they dissed me, or they dissed my family. And that ties into the shame, that feeling of you're not worthy. And that often ties into the woundedness that they grew up in, where they were disrespected by their own father, or they were disrespected by a mother or another family member. And so when you have large numbers of people who feel disrespected and feel ashamed, they look for somebody who will tell them that if you follow me, I will restore your honor, I will restore your pride, I will restore your feeling of goodness, and I'll give you somebody to attack who will be worthy of your attack. Follow me, we'll get them, and you will feel now a success rather than a failure in life. So it's a very powerful attractor. It's what, you know, attracts people all over the world, often, again, young men. Not all. There's certainly a number of women that are, you know, in these movements of attack all over the world, but often it taps the shame and the feeling of disconnection that men feel.
So let's now talk about how this gets healed. How do individuals end the pattern of, because I keep thinking of abused people have been abused and their abusers have been abused and on and on and on down the line. What are the interventions to stop this, first of all, on the individual level, so that individuals who are looking to actually become wise and powerful as opposed to overtly strong but internally weak, how do we work with people like that, first individually, and then how do we deal with this collective wound in such a way that we bring people back into the fold?
Well, so let's talk about the individual, first of all. I mean, that's what I've spent the last 50 years doing, is working individually and in couples and in small groups and teaching, training, mostly with disenfranchised or disconnected men. And I think one of the things we have to recognize, and until we do, I don't think we're going to be affected, is that most of the people that are the most violent and the ones that are causing the most problems to the society are men. And we can't just call them rioters. We can't just call them, you know, the whatever name you want to put it. We have to recognize there's something unique about what men are going through, what men need, and what kind of support and interventions in treatment male people need. So that's one part of it. That's the individual part. And I've been training counselors, therapists, coaches, all over the world in groups and classes to help teach them how to do that with men that need their help, and how to reach guys like that and how to get them the help they need. So that's the individual level. On the larger level, the social level, we need to, one, recognize what happens when you don't deal with the wounds. And you get men that are out of control and violent, and they need to be controlled. They need, just like you know, unruly people anywhere. If you let them run rampage, you know, they take over the Capitol, they burn, they kill. So on the one level, you have to stop them. You have to protect yourself. You have to. Some of them need to be locked up. Some of them need to be restrained. In some way, some of them need to be treated, some need rehab, but they have to be dealt with. Then you look upstream, you know, how did they get radicalized to a point where they felt so angry, so hopeless that they would be willing to hurt somebody or to invade or, you know, put themselves at risk. And that's education. It goes from early education with young kids all the way through adolescent into adults. And it, on the larger scale, it means solving real problems, you know, men out of work, men who are depressed, men who have anger problems. So these are not just individuals, but we need to look at this on a whole societal basis.
You know, back in the early 2000s, I heard something on NPR, and I wish I was able to track it back. And it was a study about Palestinians after the first Intifada. So it probably goes back to the 1970s. And what happened afterward, and I don't know whether this was cooperation between the Palestinian and the Israeli authorities, but a lot of these young men who joined the radical Palestinian Liberation Front and so on, what happened was it was arranged that they get married and have families. And once mm-hmm. they were married with families, all of a sudden this impulse for nihilistic destruction, my life means nothing, so I'm ready to sacrifice it for this cause, all of these things, they greatly diminished. And I've never heard of anything about that ever since then, but it certainly seemed like it was a worthy strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we're going to take another break. We'll be back with Jed Diamond very shortly and talk about how we can address this issue collectively. Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Well, we're back with Jed Diamond. We're talking about how the masculine, and I would say the sacred masculine, can emerge in this time of great crisis. You know, we need instead of the two the masculine and feminine, the yin and yang impulses being at odds with each other and pulling in different directions, what would it be like if they were actually pulling together in the same direction and using their strengths to work together to build a better society? Right now, we are facing what I'm calling a reality gap, because it's not just that we have two different ways of seeing and two different political parties. We have two different realities. And while I have concerns, some of the same concerns that some of the people who are objecting to mass vaccinations and all of that, I have some of those same concerns about top-down control, about the corporatization of America, and about the direction that we may be going toward a very Orwellian and totalitarian system. However, there are people out there who believe all kinds of very strange mythology, like the QAnon folks, and it doesn't matter how many reality checks bounce, they continue to cling to their belief and somehow regroup and rationalize, kind of like those cults where the world was supposed to end today, but it didn't. Now what do we do? What about that psychology? And number one, how do we address that psychology? First of all, the cause, and second of all, how we can, I see it as cultism, how do we break the trance of this cult and bring people back toward what I'm calling a sane and sacred center?
Well,
it's a big task,
clearly, but there are some simple solutions that can help and things that we each can do. So part of the problem is that we haven't been able and willing to focus on first the group in the society that is both, I call them the canaries in the coal mine, the ones that are expressing the woundedness the strongest, and also the ones that are causing the most danger to the larger society. And I think my experience is that that's men, and we need to pay more attention to men. For instance, in this country, we have a White House Council on the Health and Well-Being of Women, but there's never been a council on the health and well-being of men. So I think we need to pay more attention to men generally and the needs that men have generally and specifically. That would go a long way to giving men and males that are feeling angry, disenfranchised, some hope. You mentioned, before the break, the idea of one of the feelings of hopelessness that many men feel, many males feel, is they don't feel that they have the skills and the abilities to connect with women. And so they feel like, you know, lone male pariahs, that if you don't have any love in your life or you don't feel like you've got a sexual partner or a loving partner, you get angry. You get pretty. So we need to teach men skills, not just work skills, but emotional skills. So there's a need for that. And then finally, I think we have to, again, recognize that our country and the world in some ways, but here we are in our country, need to, in a sense, become clean and honest about the both woundedness that we have in our country as a whole, and the racism, the sexism, the corporatism, those, you know, the things that you talked about. We have to bring those to the surface. And if there's anything good about what's gone on in 2020 and these last 4 years before that, it's a lot of these issues that have been buried, pushed aside, pushed underground, have come to the surface. They may not be very pleasing to look at. It's horrible to see what happened in our capital, or to feel, you know, an inauguration now under siege where you've got troops that, you know, protecting the capital. But the truth is, we've had to uncover some of the dark side of our society, hopefully so that now things can be brought into the light and can be brought to the surface so that they can begin to be healed. And I feel some real hope, you know, and it's part of what I do, you know, personally through my teaching, my training, my work with people at Men Alive. That's kind of my website and my work. But there's a lot of other organizations, groups that I have connected with that are doing similar healing work of bringing people together, and particularly the healing of the masculine soul, so that men and women can come together in real partnership, which we need more of, partnership in all kinds of ways. So that's what I look forward to, is I do my work and I connect with other people here in the U.S. and throughout the world that are doing this kind of healing work.
You know, one of the things you mentioned earlier is the, in a way, neglect of men's health and supporting boys and supporting men and so on. And what's happened over this last period of time is that the Democratic Party, and I think there's certainly been a lot of reaction to this, and I think part of the Trump backlash is reaction to political correctness, identity politics. I remember a few years ago, I watched something that Michelle Obama was involved with this, and it was really on supporting girls and supporting girls, and it was so much about that. And I started thinking, what about the boys?
Right.
And so it's understandable that if, women having been disempowered for thousands and thousands of years, you want to actually help them grow into their power. But I could see that these things have to happen simultaneously. So how do we begin to introduce this emotional intelligence for boys? How do we begin to introduce that in our public schools, in our private schools, and in other domains, other public domains?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that need to be said. One is that there is a fear, and I think it's a valid fear that many women have, that if you start talking about men's issues, that what you really are saying is that we're going to take it back to the old way in which men were in charge. Men were dominant. Men kept women in their place. And that isn't the case. We really can talk about men's issues and what men need and boys need without neglecting girls. In fact, we can't be supportive of women and girls if we don't talk about men's issues, because we're all connected. I have daughters, to speak to myself, I have daughters, I have sons, I have granddaughters, I have grandsons. So we need to talk together, and we need to recognize the fear that many women have, and organizations that support women, political parties that support women, that when you talk about men's rights or men's needs or men's programs, that we're not talking about going back to the old, going back to a dominant, or at the expense of focus on women. We really are talking about now, in many ways, the balance has shifted the other way. Boys now are not graduating from high school at the same rate of girls. They're not going into college at the same rates. They're going into prisons at higher rates. So to pay attention to the boys is not at all to neglect the girls, but we have to recognize the fear, and more women are coming on board and saying, yes, we need to pay more attention to boys and men and be able to do that in a way that doesn't neglect others, but that we balance all of the issues that we need to in order to get a more just society, a more caring society, and one where sex and gender issues really are dealt with from the male side and the female side.
You mentioned the phrase partnership, and in her work over the past decades, Rianne Eisler has talked about the research done on the so-called matriarchal societies, which were really partnership societies. It wasn't that the women dominated, it's that the women actually prevented domination, period. And so,
right.
If we're looking at 1960s and 1970s feminism, which was about bringing women up to an equal par in our Western civilization, it seems like there's another evolution of both feminism and working with this evolved masculine to create this egalitarian partnership where actually both the strengths of both the intuitive and the masculine structure can be woven together. How do we begin to empower this partnership society when it seems like what used to be the women's movement and the identity politics movement is still stuck on that same old battlefield?
Well, some people are stuck in the old battlefield. Many are. You mentioned Rianne Eisler. I've been working with Rianne for 30 years, more than that probably, since she and I met, to bring together men and women, to really recognize that true partnership empowers and enhances men's and women's lives. And she's very supportive of the work that I've been doing with men and women, and I've been working with her on some of that shift from a dominator culture. And under a dominator culture, whether it's a strong man leadership, and we see with people in authoritarian positions, or just that old leadership in families of domination, we need to change the personal domination that's inside us. We need to change it in our relationships with our spouses and our partners, and we need to change it in the society. So programs like what Rianne is doing and what we're doing, and there's others, really are looking at all levels, changing the economic system of domination, changing the relational system of domination, and changing the family interaction system of domination to one of partnership. So there's many positive organizations, people, individuals that are moving in this direction. And I think we have some new awakenings, as you would put it, that I think we could all look forward to.
You know, one of the things that I've been noticing is that if we go to the people who showed up in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, a lot of those people were concerned about domination. They were concerned about being dominated, not by an individual strongman. They kind of were in favor of that, since he seemed to reflect and reinforce their already beliefs. But their fear was being dominated by what they would call a socialist system, but I would call a system where the collective makes the rules that forces them to do things that they don't want to do. Now, it can get very dicey when we're talking about a collective forcing people to get medical care or vaccinations against their will. That harkens back to the Nuremberg agreements, which prohibit that. But I think that a lot of these people who, in a certain regard, there seems to be kind of a paradox that people who call themselves libertarian would be voting for an authoritarian leader. But I think that there is a concern that about domination by this monolithic world government, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that that is an exaggerated paranoia, or is there some truth to that? And if so, how can we address that collectively in a wise way?
Well, I probably, to get into all of that would require another full program. the short answer, from my experience, I write about this every day and, post every week on my site. But the short answer is, I think both things are true. There's a certain degree of paranoia that everybody has, and on the left and the right, when we're under siege from a pandemic that's killing huge numbers of people, and we're not dealing effectively with it, the fear then gets attached to things that sometimes have no basis in fact, and people just get afraid of them. And the other side is true as well. There are some real fears of a society where we will be controlled by something that is not a good control. I mean, we all accept good controls. We want stop signs so we don't run into each other on a highway, and we don't get mad because we're forced to stop rather than just driving through intersections every which way. But what we don't want is domination by people or organizations that we don't have any connection with, or we don't trust, or we don't believe in, or we don't have any say over the decisions. So there are both real concerns that people have, and I think there are unreasonable concerns that come out of fear and you know, information that is not accurate. And we have to address all of that. And there's, again, ways to do it. But I think all of those things are true, and they're not any of them easy to deal with, but all of them are necessary.
Well, you know, the Swami is talking about this time as political climate change, and political climate mm-hmm. change can come about through warmer hearts and cooler heads. So mm-hmm. As we look at this time of change, we've got about another 30 seconds left. Oh, I guess I got trimmed by the music. Jed Diamond, thank you so much for your insights about men, about history, and about how our individual psychology can impact our collective well-being. I'm looking forward to having you on again, Jed Diamond. And by the way, on our Wiki Politiki page, there's a connection to Jed's website and Man Alive. So thanks once again, Jed, for joining us today.
My pleasure, Steve.
Okay. Steve Bremen, Wiki Politiki. We're back again next week.